The Phoenix Theater and Arts Company's audio drama series presents Frances Hodgson Burnett's The Secret Garden in 5 parts, adapted and directed by Jenna Isabella. For past episodes, upcoming events, and other information, make sure to visit our website at phoenixtheaterartsco.com. That's theater with an R-E. Without further ado, we give you The Secret Garden, Part 1.
Hello, dear listener. I'm so very pleased you've decided to join me. I love a good story, especially one with gardens, and even more especially when they are secrets. But before we get too ahead of ourselves, I believe I should properly introduce myself. I'm Mary Lennox, and although I live in England now, I didn't always. I was actually born in India, but I don't think about that time in my life much because, to be completely honest with you, listener, I was absolutely miserable there. It was far too hot, and I was always sickly. And although my parents were very prominent citizens and very social, they never cared to socialize with me. In fact, they made it pretty clear to me that they didn't want me at all. The only person who ever made time for me was my Aya. Even though this made me terribly sad, and even though I miss them a great deal sometimes, I am much happier now than I have ever been before.
Mary,
come to the garden!
Mary, come to the garden!
I'll be right there!
My dear friends are waiting for me in the garden, but before I join them, I feel I must tell you how I came to be here. Here being Misselthwaite Manor, England. You see, my parents and my Aya were taken ill by something called cholera and died. So I was sent to live with my only remaining relative, my father's sister's husband, Uncle Archibald Craven. I was placed on a ship with many other children. The weeks turned to months, and the children taunted me with a song.
Mistress Mary, quite contrary, how does your garden grow with silver bells and cockle shells and marigolds all in a row?
And they made faces at me and laughed at me. It seemed I didn't belong anywhere, and nobody could ever love me. I felt horribly alone again, and all I knew was that I was going to my uncle's home, who some called a hunchback.
Mary! Why didn't you come when we called you?
Yes, Mary, what are you doing here?
I was just beginning to tell the story of our garden and how I came to Misselthwaite.
Oh, that's a good one. Well, go on. Oh, don't let us interrupt.
Where were you in the story?
I was just about to start the part where I arrived at the shipyard in London.
Oh, is that where Mrs. Medlock found you and brought you here?
Yes, exactly. So you see, she found me when I was feeling quite dreary about simply everything. Mrs. Medlock had very red cheeks and sharp black eyes. She wore a very purple dress, a black silk mantle with jet fringe on it, and a black bonnet with purple velvet feathers. It was very evident Mrs. Medlock did not think much of me. In fact, she spoke about me to the captain's wife, as if I couldn't hear her.
My word! She's a plain little piece of goods. And we'd heard that her mother was a beauty. She hasn't handed much of it down.
Perhaps she will improve as she grows older. If she were not so sallow and had a nicer expression, her features are rather good. Children alter so much.
She'll need to alter, and there's nothing likely to improve children at Misselthwaite, if you ask me. Now come along, girl. I'll have you know I will stand no nonsense from you young ones. I'm Mrs. Medlock, the housekeeper. Your uncle Archibald Craven has sent me. He is to be your new guardian. I suppose I may tell you something about where you are going. Do you know anything about your uncle?
No.
Never heard your father and mother talk about him?
No. My father and mother never talked to me about anything.
I suppose you might as well be told something. To prepare you, you are going to a strange place. Not but that it's a grand, big place in a gloomy way, and Mr. Craven's proud of it in his way, and that's gloomy enough, too. The house is 600 years old, and it is on the edge of a moor, and there's near 100 rooms in it. Though most of them's shut up and locked. And there's pictures and fine old furniture and things that's been there for ages. And there's a big park round it and gardens and trees with branches trailing to the ground and some of them. But there's nothing else. Well, what do you think of it?
Nothing. I know nothing about such places.
Ha! But you are like an old woman. Don't you care?
It doesn't matter whether I care or not.
Well, you're right enough there. It doesn't. What you're to be kept at Misselthwaite Manor for, I don't know. Unless because it's the easiest way. He's not going to trouble himself about you. That's sure and certain. He never troubles himself about no one. He's got a crooked back. That has set him wrong. He was a sour young man and got no good of all his money and big place till he married your aunt, your father's sister. Oh, she was a sweet, pretty thing, and he'd have walked the world over to get a blade of grass she wanted. Nobody thought she'd marry him, but she did, and people said she married him for his money, but she didn't. She didn't. When she died...
Oh, did she die?
Yes, she died, and it made him sadder and stranger than ever. He cares about nobody. He won't see people. Most of the time, he goes away, and when he's at Mithelthwaite, he shuts himself up in the West Wing and won't let anyone but Pitcher see him. Pitcher's an old fellow, but he took care of him when he was a child, and he knows his ways.
I started to feel so sorry for my uncle. It sounded like everything would have been more cheerful had my aunt not died and left him alone. Mrs. Menlock assured me that
I... You needn't expect to see him, because 10 to 1 you won't. And you mustn't expect that there will be people to talk to you. You'll have to play about and look after yourself. You'll be told what rooms you can go to, and what rooms you're to keep out of. There's gardens enough. But when you're in the house, don't go wandering and poking about. Mr. Craven won't have it.
I shall not want to go poking about. And so we continued our long journey towards Yorkshire to arrive at Mithelthwaite Manor, when I suddenly remembered a question that I had been meaning to ask Mrs. Medlock. What is a mole?
Look out up that window in about 10 minutes, and you'll see. We've got to drive 5 miles across Mistle Moor before we get to the manor. You won't see much because it's a dark night, but you can see something.
And so I waited in the dark carriage, and the lamps cast rays of light out a little distance ahead of them, and I caught glimpses of a tiny village, whitewashed cottages, and the lights of a public house, a church, and a vicarage. A little shop window in a cottage with toys and sweets and odd things set out for sale. Then, on the high road, I saw hedges and trees. At last the horses began to go more slowly, as if they were climbing uphill, and there seemed to be no more hedges and no more trees. I could see nothing, in fact, but a dense darkness on either side. I leaned forward and pressed my face against the window just as the carriage gave a big jolt. A wind was rising and making a singular, mild, low rushing sound.
We're on the moor now, sure enough.
It's not the sea, is it?
No, it's not. Nor is it fields nor mountains. It's just miles and miles and miles of wild land that nothing grows on but heather and gorse and broom, and nothing lives on but wild ponies and sheep.
I feel as if it might be the sea, if there were water on it. It sounds like the sea just now.
That's the wind blowing through the bushes. It's a wild, dreary enough place to my mind, though there's plenty that likes it, particularly when the heather's in bloom.
I didn't like it. It was dark and cold and dreary. When we finally arrived at the house, I saw the massive oak entrance door studded with big iron nails and bound with great iron bars. It opened into an enormous hall, which was so dimly lighted that the faces and the portraits on the walls and the figures and the suits of armor made me feel that I should look away. As I stood on the stone floor, I felt as small and lost and odd as I must have looked. Then, a neat, thin old man stood near the manservant, who opened the door for them.
You are to take her to her room. He doesn't want to see her. He's going to London in the morning. See to it that he's not disturbed, and that he doesn't see what, or who, he doesn't want to see.
So Mrs. Medlock led me to my room and said,
Well, here you are. This room and the next are where you'll live. And you must keep to them. Don't you forget that.
I never felt quite so contrary in all my life. When I opened my eyes in the morning, it was because a young housemaid had come into my room to light the fire and was kneeling on the hearth rug, raking up the cinders noisily. I lay and watched her for a few minutes and then began to look about the room. I had never seen a room at all like it and thought it curious and gloomy. The walls were covered with a tapestry with the forest scene embroidered on it. There were fantastically dressed people under the trees, and in the distance there was a glimpse of the turrets of a castle. There were hunters and horses and dogs and ladies. I felt as if I were in the forest with them. Out of a deep window, I could see a great climbing stretch of land which seemed to have no trees on it, and it looked rather like an endless, dull, purplish sea.
Oh, I remember this, clear as day. You had never seen a moor before, and you told me you hated it. And I told you, that's because you're not used to it. You think it's too big and bare now, but you'll like it.
Do you?
Aye, that I do. I just love it. It's none bare. It's covered with growing things and smells sweet. It's fair lovely in spring and summer, when the gorse and broom and heather's in flower. It smells of honey, and there's such a lot of fresh air. And the sky looks so high, and the bees and skylarks make such a nice noise, humming and singing. I wouldn't live away from the moor for anything.
You are a strange servant.
I know that. If there was a grand missus at Misselthwaite, I should never have been even one of the under-housemaids. I might have been let to be a scullery maid, but I'd never have been let upstairs. I'm too common, and I talk too much Yorkshire. But this is a funny house for all it's so grand. Seems like there's neither master nor mistress, except Mr. Pitcher and Mrs. Medlock. Mr. Craven? He won't be troubled about anything when he's here, and he's nearly always away. Mrs. Medlock gave me the place out of kindness. She told me she could never have done it if Misselthwaite had been like other big houses.
Are you going to be my servant?
I'm Mrs. Medlock's servant, and she's Mr. Craven's. But I'm to do the housemaid's work up here and wait on you a bit. But you won't need much waiting on. It's time for you to get up now. Mrs. Medlock said I was to carry your breakfast and tea and dinner into the room next to this. It's been made into a nursery for you. I'll help thee on with thy clothes if you'll get out of bed. If the buttons are at the back, you cannot button them up yourself.
So I got out of bed and looked at the clothes that Martha took out of the wardrobe for me. There was a dress and coat made of thick white wool in her hands. Those are not mine. Mine are black. Those are nicer than mine.
These are the ones you must put on. Mr. Craven ordered Mrs. Medlock to get them in London. He said,
I won't have a child dressed in black wandering about like a lost soul, he said. It'd make the place sadder than it is. Put colour on her.
Mother, she knew what he meant. Mother always knows what a body means. She doesn't hold with black herself.
Does your mother mind your whole family?
You should see us all. There's 12 of us, and my father only gets 16 shillings a week. I can tell you my mother's put to it to get porridge for them all. They tumble about on the moor and play there all day, and Mother says the air of the moor fattens them. She says she believes they eat the grass, same as the wild ponies do. Oh, our Dickon? He's 12 years old, and he's got a young pony he calls his own.
Where did he get it?
He found it on the moor with its mother when it was a little one, and he began to make friends with it and give it bits of bread and pluck young grass for it, and it got to like him, so it follows him about and it lets him get on its back. Dickon's a kind lad, and animals like him.
I had never possessed an animal pet of my own, and I had always wanted one. I was so curious to meet Dickon. Before I could let my mind wander too far, Martha reminded me that I should be eating some breakfast, but I wasn't interested in trying porridge.
I can't abide to see good victuals go to waste. If our children was at this table, they'd clean it bare in 5 minutes.
Why?
Why, because they scarce ever had their stomachs full in their lives. They're as hungry as young hawks and foxes.
I don't know what it is to be hungry.
Well, it would do thee good to try it. I can see that plain enough. I've no patience with folk as sits and just stares at good bread and meat. My word, don't I wish Dickon and Phil and Jane and the rest of them had what's here under their pinafores.
Why don't you take it to them?
It's not mine, and this isn't my day out. I get my day out once a month, same as the rest. Then I go home and clean up for Mother and give her a day's rest.
So I drank some tea and ate a little toast and some marmalade.
Oh, you wrap up warm and run out and play, you. It'll do you good and give you some stomach for your meat.
I went to the window. There were gardens and paths and big trees, but everything looked dull and wintry. Out? Why should I go out on a day like this?
Well, if you don't go out, then you'll have to stay in. And what have you got to do?
I glanced about me. There was nothing to do. When Mrs. Medlock had prepared the nursery, she had not thought of amusement. Perhaps it would be better to go and see what the gardens were like. Who will go with me?
You'll go by yourself. You'll have to learn to play like other children do when they haven't got sisters and brothers. Our Dickon goes off on the moor by himself and plays for hours. That's how he made friends with the pony. He's got sheep on the moor that knows him, and birds that come and eat out of his hand. However little there is to eat, he always saves a bit of his bread to coax his pets.
With this mention of Dickon, I resolved to go outside. There would be birds outside, though there would not be ponies or sheep. I knew they could be different from the birds in India, and I was curious to see them. Martha found my coat and hat and a pair of stout little boots and showed me the way downstairs.
If you go round that way, you'll come to the gardens. There's lots of flowers in summertime, but there's nothing blooming now. One of the gardens is locked up. No one has been in it for 10 years.
Why?
Mr. Craven had it shut when his wife died so sudden. He won't let no one go inside. It was her garden. He locked the door and dug a hole and buried the key. There's Mrs. Medlock's bell ringing. I must run.
After Martha left, I turned down the walk, which led to the door in the shrubbery. I could not help thinking about the garden, which no one had been into for 10 years. What would it look like? Would there be any flowers still alive in it? Then I passed through the shrubbery gate, and I found myself in great gardens with wide lawns and winding walks with clipped borders. There were trees and flower beds, and evergreens clipped into strange shapes, and a large pool with an old grey fountain in its midst. But the flower beds were bare and wintry, and the fountain was not plain. This was not the garden which was shut up. How could a garden be shut up? You could always walk into a garden. Then I saw that, at the end of the path, there seemed to be a long wall with ivy growing over it. Without realizing it initially, I had come upon the kitchen gardens, where the vegetables and fruit were growing. I went toward the wall and found that there was a green door in the ivy, and that it stood open. This was not the closed garden, evidently. Then an old man, with a spade over his shoulder, walked through the door leading from the second garden. He looked startled when he saw me, and then touched his cap. He had a surly old face and did not seem at all pleased to see me. But then again, I was not very pleased to see him. What is this place?
One of the kitchen gardens.
What is that?
Another of them. There is another on the other side of the wall, and there is the orchard on the other side of that.
Can I go in then?
If you like, but there is naught to see.
So I continued on the path and through the second green door. I found more walls and winter vegetables and glass frames, but in the second wall there was another green door, and it was not open. I wondered if it led to the garden which no one had seen for 10 years. I could not bear to wait, so I went to the green door and turned the handle. I had hoped the door would not open because I wanted to be sure I had found the mysterious garden, but it did open quite easily, and I walked through it and found myself in an orchard. There were walls all around it also, and trees trained against them, and there were bare fruit trees growing in the winter brown grass, but there was no green door to be seen anywhere. I looked for it, and yet when I had entered the upper end of the garden, I had noticed that the wall did not seem to end with the orchard, but extend beyond it, as if it enclosed a place at the other side. I could see the tops of the trees above the wall, and when I stood still, I saw a bird with a bright red breast sitting on the topmost branch of one of them, and suddenly he burst into his winter song, almost as if he had caught sight of me and was calling to me, and somehow his cheerful, friendly little whistle gave me a pleased feeling. As lonely as I had felt, and as unloved and as forgotten as I had believed myself to be, I found myself beginning to smile as he sang his cheerful tune. He flew off, and I wondered if I would ever see him again. Perhaps he lived in the mysterious garden and knew all about it. But why had Uncle Archibald buried the key? If he had liked his wife so much, why did he hate her garden? Will I ever see him? If I do, I shall have to ask him about the garden. As I stood there thinking, a thought occurred to me. I believe that tree was in the secret garden. I felt sure it was. There was a wall round the place, and there was no door. So I walked back into the first kitchen garden and found the old man digging there. I have been into the other gardens.
There was nothing to prevent thee.
I went into the orchard.
There was no dog at the door to bite thee.
There was no door into the other garden.
What garden?
He stopped his digging for a moment. The one on the other side of the wall. There are trees there. I saw the tops of them. The bird with a red breast was sitting in one of them, and he sang. Almost the next moment, a wonderful thing happened. The bird with the red breast flew to us, and he actually alighted on the big clod of earth quite near the gardener's foot.
Here he is! Where have you been, you cheeky little beggar? I've not seen you before today. Have you begun your courting this early in the season? You are too forward.
The bird put his tiny head on one side and looked up at him as his soft, bright eye, which was like a black dewdrop. He seemed quite familiar and not the least afraid. He hopped about and pecked the earth briskly, looking for seeds and insects. Will he always come when you call him?
Aye, that he will. I've known him ever since he was a fledgling. He come out of the nest in the other garden and... when he first flew over the wall, he was too weak to fly back for a few days, and we got friendly. When he went over the wall again, the rest of the brood was gone, and he was lonely, and he come back to me.
What kind of bird is he?
Don't you know? He's a robin redbreast, and they're the friendliest, curiousest birds alive. They're almost as friendly as dogs, if you know how to get on with them. Watch him pecking around there and looking round at us now and again. He knows we're talking about him. He's a conceited one. He likes to hear folk talk about him, and curious. Bless me, there never was his like for curiosity in Medlin. He's always coming to see what I'm planting. He knows all the things Master Craven never troubles hisself to find out. He's the head gardener, he is.
Where do the rest of his brood fly to?
There's no knowing. The old ones turn them out of their nest and make them fly, and they're scattered before you know it. This one was a knowing one, and he knew he was lonely.
I'm lonely.
Are you the little girl from India? Then no wonder you're lonely. You'll be lonelier before you're done.
What is your name?
Ben Weatherstaff. I'm lonely myself, except when he's with me. He's the only friend I've got.
I have no friends at all. I never had. My Aya didn't like me, and I never played with anyone.
You and me are a good bit alike. We was wove out of the same cloth. We're neither of us good-looking, and we're both of us as sour as we look. We've got the same nasty tempers, both of us, I'll warrant.
Just then, the bird flew to one of the apple tree branches and burst into song. What did he do that for?
He's made up his mind to make friends with you. Dang me if he hasn't took a fancy to you.
To me? Would you make friends with me? Would you?
Why, you said that as nice and human as if you were a real child instead of a sharp old woman. You said it almost like Dickon talking to his wild things on the moor.
Do you know Dickon?
Everybody knows him. Dickon's wandering about everywhere. The very blackberries and heatherbells know him. I warrant the foxes show him where their cubs lie and the skylarks don't hide their nests from him.
He has flown over the wall. He has flown into the orchard. He has flown across the other wall, into the garden where there is no door.
He lives there. He came out of the egg there. If he's courting, he's making up to some young madam of a robin that lives among the old rose trees there.
Rose trees? Are there rose trees?
And that was 10 years ago.
I should like to see them. Where is the green door? There must be a door somewhere.
That was 10 years ago. But there isn't now.
No door? There must be.
None as anyone can find. And none as is anyone's business. Don't you be a meddlesome lass and poke your nose where it's no cause to go. Here, I must go on with my work. Get you gone and play, you. I've no more time.
And Ben took his spade and left me without so much as a word goodbye.
Aw, he meant no harm, you know. And the days passed without giving it another thought.
If I remember rightly, you cared about nothing more than waking each morning and exploring the grounds in search of Mistress Craven's hidden garden door.
Yes, and the moor gave you stomach for your victuals.
But Mary was more concerned about her new friend, the robin. Isn't that right?
I returned to the wall just beyond where I first met Ben and the robin nearly every day. Then, one day, I saw the gleam of scarlet, and I heard a brilliant chirp. The bird was perched on top of the wall and looked down at me. "Good morning," I said to him. I followed him as he hopped merrily along the wall. I ran up the walk. I looked at the tree beyond the wall where the robin sat, and I knew it had to be the garden I searched for. It's very clear. Ben Weatherstaff said there was no door, and there is no door. But there must have been one 10 years ago, because Mr. Craven buried the key.
You never stopped thinking about the garden.
I couldn't understand why Mr. Craven hated the garden.
Listen to the wind wuthering round the house. You could bear stand up on the moor if you was out on it tonight.
But why did he hate it so?
Mind, Mrs. Medlock said it's not to be talked about. There's lots of things in this place that's not to be talked over. That's Mr. Craven's orders. His troubles are none servant's business, he says. But for the garden, he wouldn't be like he is. It was Mrs. Craven's garden that she had made when first they were married, and she just loved it. And they used to tend the flowers themselves. And none of the gardeners was ever let to go in. Him and her used to go in and shut the door and stay there hours and hours reading and talking. And she was just a bit of a girl, and there was an old tree with a branch bent like a seat on it, and she made roses grow over it, and she used to sit there. But one day, when she was sitting there, the branch broke, and she fell on the ground and was hurt so bad that next day she died. The doctors thought he'd go out of his mind and die too. That's why he hates it. No one's ever gone in since, and he won't let anyone talk about it.
I didn't ask any more questions about the garden for a while. I just listened to the wind withering. It seemed to be withering louder than ever, but as I was listening to the wind, I began to hear something else. I did not know what it was, because at first I could scarcely distinguish it from the wind itself. It was a curious sound. It seemed almost as if a child were crying somewhere. Sometimes the wind sounded rather like a child crying, but I was sure this crying was coming from inside the house, not outside on the moor. Do you hear anyone crying?
No, it's the wind. Sometimes it sounds as if someone was lost on the moor and wailing. It's got all sorts of sounds.
But listen, it's in the house, down one of those long corridors.
It was the wind. And if it wasn't, it was little Betty Butterworth, the scullery maid. She's had the toothache all day.
I was still skeptical, but decided not to question Martha further. The following day, the rain was torrential, forcing me to stay indoors. What do you do in your cottage when it rains like this?
Try to keep from under each other's feet, mostly. Ah, there does seem a lot of us then. The biggest ones go out in the cowshed and play there. Dickon, he doesn't mind the wet. He goes out just the same as if the sun were shining. He says he sees things on rainy days as doesn't show when it's fair weather. He once found a little fox cub half drowned in its hole, and he brought it home in the bosom of his shirt to keep it warm. Its mother had been killed nearby, and the hole was swum out and the rest of the litter was dead. He's got it home now. He found a half-drowned young crow another time, and he brought it home too and tamed it. It's named Soot because it's so black, and it hops and flies about with him everywhere.
If I had a raven or a fox cub, I could play with it, but I have nothing.
Can you knit?
No.
Can you sew?
No.
Can thou read?
Yes.
Then why doesn't you read something, or learn a bit of spelling? You're old enough to be learning thy book a good bit now.
I haven't any books. Those I had were left in India.
Oh, that's a pity. If Mrs. Medlock would let you in the library, there's thousands of books there.
I did not ask where the library was, because I was suddenly inspired by a new idea. To go and find it myself. I did not care very much about the library itself, because I had read very few books, but to hear of it brought back to my mind the 100 rooms with closed doors. I wondered if they were all really locked, and what I would find if I could get into any of them. So I began wandering about, gazing at the portraits, and wondering what about the lives of the people I saw. I lost my way 2 or 3 times, trying a door here and there. I stood for a little while, trying to get my bearings, when suddenly the stillness of the moment was broken by a sound. It was another cry, but not quite like the one I had heard the night before. It was only a short one, a fretful, childish whine muffled by passing through walls. My heart began to beat faster as I realized the cry was much nearer than it was. In an effort to steady myself, I put my hand accidentally upon the tapestry near me, and then sprang back, feeling quite startled. The tapestry was the covering of a door, which fell open and showed me that there was another part of the corridor behind it, and Mrs. Medlock was coming up it, with her bunch of keys in her hand and a very cross look on her face.
What are you doing here? What did I tell you?
I turned round the corner. I didn't know which way to go, and I heard someone crying.
You didn't hear anything of the sort. You came along back to your own nursery, or I'll box your ears.
And she took me by the arm, and half pushed, half pulled me up one passage, and down another, until she pushed me in at the door of her own room.
Now, you stay where you're told to stay, or you'll find yourself locked up. The master had better give you a governess, same as he said he would. You're one that needs someone to look sharp after you. I've got enough to do.
But there was no denying what I heard in the corridor. There was someone crying. There was! And I was more determined now to uncover the secrets piling up around me.
I never knew you crept around looking for the crying, or that you spent so long in search of the secret garden.
That was only the beginning. I'll have to tell you all the rest next time.
P-TAC's audio drama series is a production by the Phoenix Theatre and Arts Company. This week's episode, The Secret Garden, Part 1, was written by Frances Hodgson Burnett, adapted and directed by Jenna Isabella, and edited by Gina Stanton and Jenna Isabella. This episode features the vocal talents of Amanda Booth as Mary Lennox, Gina Stanton as Martha Sowerby, Devin Traeger as Dickon Sowerby, Emma Burke-Kovitz as Colin Craven, Judy Brewster as Mrs. Medlock, Sean Lataza as Ben Weatherstaff and Mr. Pitcher, and Jasmine Canziani as the captain's wife. Original P-TAC music by Brian Sanishin. For a full listing of credits, visit us at phoenixtheaterartsco.com. That's theater with an R-E. While you're there, please consider clicking the donate link. That would be delightful. Have comments or questions? Email us at phoenixtheaterartsco@gmail.com or find us on social media. A very special thank you to our Patreon subscribers, with a shout out to those sitting in the box seats, Ken Shelby, and on stage seating, Margaret Thurston. We couldn't do this without you. Join us next time for The Secret Garden, Part 2.